Hello, everyone. I'm Therese Bottomley, editor of The Oregonian and Oregon Live. This is Beat Check with The Oregonian. Today, I've invited Nicole Hayden, our reporter who covers the crisis of unsheltered Portlanders, to talk about all of the recent activity around the city's homelessness problem. So, Nicole, Portland has been grappling with this crisis of the unsheltered for decades, but the pandemic, as we know, really exacerbated the problem. But after a long period where people may have perceived little progress, it suddenly seems like there's a lot going on. So let's break it down for listeners. First, just as an overview, there are several players in this field. Metro, which gives money to the county and the city, money from a new tax. Then there's the county, which accepts money from Metro and the city of Portland to take the lead on the crisis. And then the city itself, which conducts sweeps and works to establish safe rest villages. So let's start there. Where do we stand with safe rest villages?
Yeah, so as a reminder, a couple years ago, Portland Commissioner Dan Ryan announced intentions to open 6 of these safe rest villages by the end of 2021. Now we just have 1 left to open, and our 5th one just opened recently this summer. And in addition to that, during the process of opening these 5 safe rest villages, the city also kind of relocated and made more permanent 2 other temporary pod villages that were open during the pandemic. So now we have essentially 7 of these villages open with 1 still remaining to open soon. And they've been really successful. The ones that have opened, slightly more than 50% of the folks who have moved on from them have found housing. So far, they're doing good things for our residents.
So just to be clear, each safe rest village, you know, houses not a lot of people, maybe several dozen, when we have, you know, several thousand on the street.
That's correct. They housed maybe like 30 to 60 people.
Okay, so one piece of the solution. So the other piece is this city-county joint office. And this joint office was recently audited. What did the audit find?
Yeah, it basically highlighted the things that the nonprofit contractors that the joint office pays to deliver services to unhoused folks, what they've been saying for years and years. It's that the joint office has failed to pay providers on time, which means they can't get rent checks out the door or pay their staff. It's the joint office has asked these nonprofits to work before their contracts are even finalized. There's a lot of what seems like chaos with lack of organization and accountability. The joint office was not able to provide data on the number of people it housed, which is not only something the auditor's office asked for many times, it's something I've asked for multiple times and haven't gotten. And it really concerning, it found that joint office staff adjusted performance metrics when nonprofits were not able to meet initial targets. And it also failed to review equity plans submitted by providers. So a long list of complaints.
Yeah, the interesting, I found the turnover of employees very interesting. I think they said they had turned over 250 people out of something like 300.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. That's extraordinary. One, and maybe speaks to the lack of getting money, you know,
right. Mm-hmm.
Et cetera. But also the thing that we knew and was underscored by the audit was this lack of data, mm-hmm. that every time we try to measure, are these efforts being successful, there's a distinct lack of any sort of metrics to be shared.
Mm-hmm.
So, Metro, the regional government, which I think a lot of people hear that name and they don't really know what it is. It runs the zoo, mm-hmm. and you know, the convention center and other things. But what role does Metro play in the homelessness solution?
Yeah, it now plays a big part because Metro is the regional government that allocates the student homeless tax dollars for Multnomah, Clackamas, and Washington counties. And as a reminder, that fund was approved by voters in May 2020 and is a 10-year tax that boosts our social services program. And they're also now the ones responsible for holding all the counties accountable to spend that money and to make sure it appropriately helps the people it intends to help.
And to be clear, we're talking about millions of dollars when you add up what the city spends, the county and Metro. Give us a sense of the, I mean, I think the city county office, it was about $255 million.
Correct. It's millions. And, you know, when people ask what's the solution to homelessness, it's more, really just more money. We're pretty good at getting people housed, knowing how to help people, but we just lack money, we lack housing. And that's important when we think about all this millions coming in and the joint office only spent about half of the money in the first three quarters of 2023. And that's, you know, in addition to this audit that was criticizing the joint office, now the joint office also has to work with Metro to get on this corrective spending plan to make sure money is actually getting out the door.
So there's two issues. Mm-hmm. One is they had money and they didn't spend it. Mm-hmm. And I think your stories have dealt with that, but it's kind of a little mind-boggling, I think, for people to understand. It's like, what happened there? I mean, all these millions of dollars are in hand, but what's going on that everything is so bogged down?
Yeah. You know, part of it is the nonprofits just didn't receive the money from the joint office. And, you know, a lot of nonprofits expressed a lot of frustration because they could help more people if they had this money. And I think some of the issues of getting the money out the door was highlighted in the audit that really underscored the kind of chaotic environment at the joint office. Just these processes, like the audit showed that maybe there was a contract that needed to be paid that was maybe $300,000 and it got held up because the nonprofit didn't provide proof for like a $25 check or something like that. And so the joint office has stated that they're working on that. But then at the same time, once the nonprofits do get this money was meant for rent assistance and services, and it didn't come with support for the people who actually provide these services. So with more money means more work, and you're getting more, that means you can help more families, more individuals. And so you're asking these folks with already dozens of families to kind of double that and do twice as much work. And that's just hard. There's only so many hours in the day, and these folks are under really emotional conditions that they're dealing with at work. They're not paid a lot. So the nonprofits are asking the joint office to, one, give more money for staffing so they can hire more people, but also increase what the contract so that they can pay the folks enough money where those folks providing housing services don't also need those same housing services they're providing.
Yeah, I noticed that was part of the county plan was to set some of that millions aside for boosting salaries. You've written about this issue that some of the very people working to help people get out of homelessness are in danger themselves of, you know, living paycheck to paycheck or that close to the brink. Mm-hmm. So it's a really interesting issue. You know, the New York Times wrote recently about Portland and how the fentanyl crisis intersects with homelessness and the inability of people to get shelter or get help through the existing services. But they featured a man who'd moved here from elsewhere. And, you know, I think sometimes people think that a lot of homeless people move here because of services or because of the weather being more temperate or what have you. So what do we know about the people who live on our streets and where they're from?
Yeah, that's a pretty common belief no matter where you're living. A lot of people always think like, these folks are coming to us. It's not our city doing this. Some other city must be forcing this on us. But Most people who are homeless in Portland are from Portland, or the last place they were housed was Portland. And, you know, before we dive into that homeless data, it's worth noting that nearly half of Oregon's overall population is from another state. We just overall, like, people move here for the lifestyle, for jobs, just like people move to California for the lifestyle, for jobs, things like that. And we're also a good option for LGBTQ folks who have experienced discrimination, hate, unsafe living conditions, no access to, like, needed medical care. So there are reasons why anyone would want to move here. But also, when people move here, that means they're likely moving away from their support system or family, and then they show up and realize we're a very expensive state to live in. Our housing is very costly, and maybe when they get their first paycheck, they weren't expecting so much taxes to be taken out compared to where they're living before. But then when you do dive down into the homeless data, it shows that only 7% of folks who were homeless reported moving here for services. But that doesn't mean they're necessarily coming from other states. They could be coming from other places in Oregon. And we know in rural Oregon, there are much fewer resources to access, or people could even just be coming from, you know, a mile away, just over the county line. So, you know, just saying people move here from elsewhere doesn't really dive into, like, really the complexities of what people are experiencing day to day. But we also know that people leave Oregon for services too. Like I've heard, you know, when people need access to youth mental health residential beds, they have to leave the state. So it's not just unique to Portland, not just unique to homelessness. It's just part of the big ecosystem overall.
And you've done something kind of unique in the city, which is you've surveyed people living on the streets with the help of Street Roots, the local newspaper that is sold by vendors. Mm-hmm. People may have seen them standing outside of grocery stores. These are folks who are experiencing or have experienced homelessness who are selling the newspaper. Mm-hmm. But you teamed up with Street Roots and surveyed folks living unsheltered. And what did they tell you about their experience, and especially the barriers to getting off the streets?
Yeah, for folks who are trying to get off the street on their own, without the help of an outreach worker, they really have a hard time finding an affordable housing unit. And then if they do find housing units that are available, they have a hard time, you know, passing all the checks that are needed, background checks, rental history checks, credit checks. And so what's helpful is when you have a housing caseworker or an outreach worker helping you navigate that landlord relationship, so they can say, you know, yeah, there's a poor credit history, but this is what we're working on, this is what we've overcome, and also I'll be here to support this person. So, but it's really hard for folks who are unsheltered to kind of know where to start. You know, if outreach workers aren't going to where folks are living, and if folks don't have access to the internet or can charge their phones, they don't really know where they're supposed to go. They're just maybe wandering aimlessly to a neighborhood where they've heard services are. So just making that initial contact of getting assistance is really hard. And then if you're living on the street and you're going through this months-long process, and maybe you can't charge your phone, so you missed a call from your caseworker or something. All these things add up to making the process longer, more challenging. And, you know, once you get to the point where you're approved for rental assistance, then you have to start navigating the landlord, the available rental units, and there's just not much available. And when there is an affordable rental unit available, you know, everyone's competing for it. So it's just this very difficult race and game and of competing against one another.
It does sound very easy to fall off the list. Yeah. Once you get on the list for a place, it sounds like it wouldn't take much to fall off the list.
No, if you can't charge your phone, so you miss, what, 3 phone calls, then a caseworker just moves on to one of the other many, many people that they're working with.
And this is assuming, I mean, we know that many of the people on the street may have mental illnesses that prevent them from following up on things. They may have addiction issues. So yeah, very complex, very complex problem. So, you know, it's almost September. It's almost the end of what we think of as summer. The weather is going to start turning. We have a few showers today. We're recording this on Monday with drizzle coming down outside. And as the weather turns, will we start seeing tents being distributed again? What's the status on the tents?
Yeah. So it was only a Portland Street Response that had a ban on handing out tents. And those workers make up a small portion of the overall workers who are distributing tents in Multnomah County. And the joint office actually has a large warehouse of supplies that organizations can pick up and hand out when they see necessary. And, you know, maybe in the summer when things, the temperatures are better, people also might have a less interest in tents. But as we see the temperatures getting chillier and more rainy, I think we will see an uptick of tents being handed out as the weather worsens. But what's also happening is, you know, more aggressive sweeps. So as these tents are being handed out, they're also then being thrown away. And just anecdotally, I live near Old Town, and yeah, I've seen many, many more people just laying, sleeping directly on the sidewalk and fewer tents. But I think we will see tent distribution again in the winter because just the weather necessitates it. But it'll just be interesting to see how aggressively those tents are swept during the depths of winter.
Yeah, we've talked a little bit about these efforts. You mentioned the sweeps. You've also heard the word reset. You know, I know the inner Southeast reset to me appeared anecdotally to just shift everybody 10 blocks east, you know. So it is a tricky issue in terms of city workers essentially chasing people from one spot to another. I don't know. We haven't talked a lot about fentanyl in the intersection, but I have heard that fentanyl maybe creates a sense of paranoia where somebody doesn't want to be in a shelter, or a tent is a safer place in their mind given the drug-induced paranoia or whatever it is. I don't know a lot about it, but tell me how you think fentanyl intersects with the difficulty in getting people off the street.
Well, I think even before fentanyl, people had poor experiences in shelters, so there was already this kind of logical paranoia. But then when you add in fentanyl and this new meth that is even more powerful. Yeah, people are experiencing a lot of drug-induced psychosis, drug-induced paranoia, and it makes people more scared and more kind of defensive. So in their minds, they feel like they need to just survive alone just to get through the day and get through the night safely. And you kind of have to have luck of interacting with someone in their lucid state and, you know, making them feel safe in that moment to maybe try shelter or try a detox bed or something. But all those things are not long-term, and someone who is part of the fentanyl crisis needs a long-term residential bed to really get through that now like medical emergency that's like, going through their body, and we can't really adequately serve those people right now. We weren't expecting such a big shift in what the, you know, drug crisis was going to look like, and we're not prepared for that. And so we lack those beds, but we also overall lack shelter beds. You know, our shelter beds are often at capacity, and then in the winter even more so. So it's difficult for people to navigate and find the shelter that's right for them.
Yeah, I was going to ask about that. I mean, we know that there were court rulings about you can't criminalize, you know, people sleeping outside if you don't have a bed to offer them. But, you know, what's on the horizon for winter? I mean, where do we stand with beds for people?
We just opened in the city of Portland one of these mass pod sites, and that Hopefully will be a good thing as we look into winter, because these are individual units that have heat and AC, so people are protected from weather. They also feel safe. They have their own locking door, and supposedly more of these are on the horizon. More before winter, probably not. So every winter we do expand our shelter capacity by hundreds of beds. And then on our worst nights, we pop up, you know, these severe weather shelter beds. But again, our homeless population is around 6,000 people, and our permanent year-round shelter beds is around 2,000. So we're always not going to be able to serve the need.
Okay, with that, I'll call it a wrap. Thanks so much for listening to Beat Check with the Oregonian. If you like this show, give us a 5-star rating and review in Apple Podcasts. It really helps people find the show. Tell a friend, help spread the word. The best way to support our journalism and stories like this one is with a subscription to Oregon Live. You can do that at oregonlive.com/podsupport. Until next time.